This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every single week, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. But, Matthew, something feels a little off tonight. It's a little strange. You look almost normal, but something's a little weird, and Admiral Nechayev is with you. What is going on?
Chris, great news, great news. The Federation, we've just made peace with our biggest enemies. It's fantastic. You need to get over here, hop on a plane. It's going great. We're giving up every freedom known to man, and we're going to have to give up Hawaii and Puerto Rico. But hey, peace will be had forever. So we're really excited about that.
I guess Hawaii and Puerto Rico are going to be the concern of the Dominion now.
Yes, they are. Although they've promised to treat the people very nicely. So that's good. I'm excited to hear that. They deserve it. Plus, I mean, we're going to want to still be able to visit Hawaii. It's a nice place.
Well, I would because... you know, an opportunity to see some Jim Hadar hula dancing with a grass skirt on. I can't pass that up.
Goodness. I don't know if anybody needed that thought in their brain, but anyway.
You know, they're going to be so relaxed. The Ketracel White is going to be replaced with a nice pina colada.
Oh, I was going to say the Ketracel White will just be flowing like wine.
It's coconut milk. All right. Well, let's just jump into our discussion here today. And we're talking about this because we're going to talk about a very specific topic, and that is the Dominion's invasion tactics, how they test the waters to find out the best approach when they want to conquer another world. And after they made contact with the Federation, they discovered what was going on in the Alpha Quadrant. And, of course, Odo came back, and they reunited with him. The Dominion, they started turning their eye towards the other side of the wormhole. But how are they going to...
The other side of the wormhole.
That's perfect. Oh, but how are they going to handle what's on the other side of the wormhole? That was the big question.
You know, Chris, I was just thinking about this. One of the most interesting ways that they decided they would handle... the universe at large is that they sent out the 100 and yeah. They send out this 100 and then none of them return until Odo. But then you notice that they never listen to Odo, which I thought was so interesting is that they've sent this being out. That's one of their own. The reason they sent him out because they want to learn about the universe. They want to learn about solids and see how solids, interact with them and how they treat them. And then Odo gets there, shares all of his experiences with them, and then they just completely disregard him. So I just thought that was a really interesting thing is that, you know, that's their first inclination, you know, after hiding themselves is to send out this 100, and then they don't actually listen when the 100, or at least one of the 100 returns.
Right.
And then they move forward.
Well, they didn't
want
to hear what he had to say.
Right, exactly. And maybe it's just because... the 100 had been gone so long that
Yeah.
You know, their fear maybe has grown or something like that. But it just, it seems like it's such an interesting thing. Like, it's a great idea. See what happens when you send out your most precious and vulnerable beings that represent your race, and how the people deal with them, and you learn so much because you know you learn very much how a society deals with its most innocent of beings, its most helpless of beings. And then of course, you know, especially with Odo's return, they just don't really pay attention to what he has to say at all. They just discount it. I think that's really interesting. So
I thought about the point you just made about maybe too much time had passed, and do you feel like the changelings, do they have any difference in their perception of the passage of time from solids, or is it pretty much all the same to them? I guess the impression I get is that it's pretty much all the same. But then again, they are, like, when they come together, they're just this giant pool. And it's kind of an odd concept.
I think that that's a good question. And it brings up the fact that, you know, for them, you know, I don't think that time passes the same way it does for us, since they're pretty much immortal unless somebody kills them, you know, with a phaser or something like that. And so... And one of them has obviously, we learn, has never harmed another changeling until Odo. And so, you know, you don't get a lot of changelings, I guess, dying. And so for them, time is kind of almost irrelevant.
Yeah.
And so that is interesting. And yet still, it seems like maybe in some ways the 100 had been gone so long, and a lot maybe had happened to the founders at that point, you know, to increase their mistrust of solids, so that by the time Odo gets back, you know, it's only one of them, and it's not really, his experience can't dictate our entire course of action for our entire society, and can't override everything that we've already experienced. Like, maybe that's what it was, but still, it just seems so interesting to me that the point is sending them out to see what they can learn, and then they bring it back, and you're like, oh, well, that's great, but we're still going to pursue this course of action.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like with the time element that events certainly are linear for them when they are taking a form like Odo or the female changeling. But I feel like when they go into the pool, it might be like if we went into stasis, and then when we come out, maybe 100 years has passed, but we don't realize it, because what we remember was that, well, we were out here a few moments ago. I don't know.
Yeah.
So it is interesting, and that may influence again why they take the approach that they do when they finally do get back some information from one of the hundreds that went up.
Yeah. And you do have a point there, because when Odo and the female changeling are merged, he comes out of it and has no recollection of how much time has passed, because that's a really good point.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Dominion themselves to set up the discussion here. And, you know, the writers created the Dominion to be sort of a parallel to the Roman Empire. And when we think about Star Trek and we think about the Federation or the Klingon Empire or Borg space or whatever it is, obviously the geographic area is vast because we're dealing with space and stars are very, very far apart. But with the Federation, it feels more cohesive, right? It feels like the United States or the European Union, where you have a group of political bodies who are all in it together for some greater goal. And the communication channels are maybe more open. They have a singular identity. But with the Dominion, we encounter these different worlds that are under Dominion control, who they don't really know who's controlling them. They've never seen the Founders. They've heard of the Vorta, but maybe they haven't met them. They trade within the Dominion, but they seem to be their own entities themselves, if that makes sense. And so it's kind of like the Roman Empire, where you had these holdings spread all over Europe and Africa and Asia, and there was a central government, but things were so far away, communication wasn't necessarily so open. How do you see the Dominion in that context?
Yeah, it is really interesting. I mean, when you look at the idea of the Roman Empire and that they really conquered by not just military force, but then kind of forcibly annexing places. But
that's
then
the other thing, right? Yeah,
right. And their main focus too was is that you paid tribute to them, and they really let you kind of do your own thing. I mean, as long as you paid homage to Caesar, you could worship who you wanted. You had, you had kind of a normal life, and yet you were you at the same time you had oppressive Roman rule. You had strict taxation. You had to follow Roman law, and that's very much the way Dominion seems to operate. You have some semblance of a normal life, and yet you have this oppressive feeling that you always have something over your head, and the Dominion is always there in the background. And the moment that you act up, they send in the Legion or, you know, the Jem'Hadar. And so, and they mop you up if you don't behave. And so, it's a really good, I think, analogy in the fact that they did kind of choose this idea of this Roman Empire, because it is really scary. This kind of unmovable force keeps, you know, spreading outwards, and it seems like there's no stop to it. And they do kind of conquer in many different ways, not just one. I mean, they're not just destroying people and marching across the galaxy, taking over people by force. They're using lots of different ways, and that kind of makes them, I think, scary and shrewd and very tactical and not something that you can just, I think, have one sure answer for. So,
right. I think that's how the Klingons and especially the Romulans view the Federation as well.
Yeah. That is a good call.
Especially the Romulans. If you think about the fact, it's in the beginning, I think this is in a novel, isn't it? Is it Taking Wing? Is it the first Titan novel where they go to Romulus and Troi walks into the Senate floor and she sees the map on the floor and she sees how it's divided between the Federation and the Romulan Empire? And she says, like, is this how they see the world? Is this how they see the galaxy? It's them and us.
Yeah, I think that other people do, and mainly you notice that it always tends to be the species in Star Trek that are more xenophobic and very protective of who they are as a nation. And I was talking about this with Una McCormick on Literary Treks about her newest book about the Cardassians, about this fact that they really operate like this in the sense that they have this feeling that they are superior to everybody else, and everybody else really kind of should bow to them, just to who they are. And, the Romulans have that kind of, you know, xenophobic idea that and pride in who they are, that they're better than everyone else and everybody else should kind of serve them. And, of course, the Founders have that, but in a completely different way. It's not just xenophobia, but it's also fear because of the way that they have been kind of treated in the past and feared by Solids, and therefore that fear is just kind of been turned back out towards the universe. Okay, we're just going to take you over so we don't have to worry about this anymore.
Right. Well, let's transition as we're talking about Romulans and other races and talk about conquering tactics in Star Trek in general. So before we talk about how the Dominion approaches conquering other worlds and some specific instances that we've seen in the series, how does it compare to how other enemies in Star Trek approach invasion or conquering? So if we want to start with the, let's say, just the extreme charge in method, I guess would be the Borg, right? Where the Borg are just like, we're going to take over, here we come, and maybe we're only going to send one cube, but there's nothing you can do to stop us. We've decided we want your land, here we come, so life as you know it is over. From this day forward, you will serve us.
Yeah, and I mean, they're pretty upfront about it.
They're very upfront about it.
Yeah, resistance is futile, so yes. Good luck. peace out. We've, you know,
luck is futile.
Exactly. The luck has nothing to do with this. So yeah, I think
that's my favorite Tina Turner song, by the way.
Luck has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Oh, such a good song. but yeah, I think that's something that's it's really, you know, there are the in your face enemy that there's nothing you can do to stop them. You know, I think in the end they really did over and over again prove there was not a lot you could do to stop them. The Borg are probably, I guess next to the Dominion, probably the scariest enemy, because of their relentless pursuit of what they want. And they don't really care about, in some ways, their own lives at all anymore. They just care about the Borg collective moving forward, and they'll sacrifice as many as it takes to get there. So,
right. Yeah, but they're a different kind of scary than the Dominion, as we'll talk about, in that they're, as you said, they're very upfront. I mean, you know what's coming. So it's scary that it could happen to you. There's not much you can do about it.
Right.
Now, what about the Klingons, for example? Because that's the classic, going all the way back to the original series. And as we talked about on Literary Treks this past week, the Organian peace treaty and the fact that the Klingons and the Federation are always at each other, especially the Klingons want to invade Federation space. They want to push the Federation back, take a greater control of this part of the galaxy. How do you see their tactics?
You know, and it's funny because the Klingons in some ways are very much a kind of in your face enemy as well. Now they're a little bit less, in your face than the Borg, in the sense that they're going to use as any way possible. They're not quite like the Romulans, where they're going to use as much, stealth or deceit or that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're similar to the Borg in that they're going to use force. You know, they're going to attack first. We even see that going all the way back into the 22nd century on Enterprise, where, you know, like even after Archer rescues a Klingon ship and sleeping dogs, when the captain wakes up, his first reaction is to blow the NX-01 out of the sky. Mm-hmm. So that's just their thing. But they're easier to deal with in that, in terms of power, they're on par with the Federation. So there's a balance of power there. Mm-hmm. And you can talk to them, and they will work with you if it's for the greater good, which is something that I want to say something we'd never see with the Borg. I mean, yes, Janeway works out a deal with the Borg, which was ridiculous, but it happened. But let's just discount that for a minute. The Borg in general are that you can't talk to them, right? Because they're this relentless force. So the Klingons have similarities in their use of force, in their boldness to push forward, but you can work with them. And then that leads to the Romulans, because I'm trying to transition us towards the Dominion here, because I feel that a step down from the Borg threat would be Klingons. And then it moves to the Romulans, where it's a lot more, there's a lot more political intrigue going on in the way that they would approach any type of invasion.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot more devious nature. They're really trying to get the most for the least amount of input, you know, like, you know, so if they can use some sort of, stealth, they love their Tal Shiar and their underhanded dealings, looking for the easiest way to get the best result. And two, to also, in a lot of ways, still look innocent if they get caught. So they're one of the most devious races in Star Trek in that way. Even more so, say, than the Cardassians with the Obsidian Order. The Romulans really hate to get their hands caught in the cookie jar and to be, you know, put out in front of the galaxy, hey, the Romulans did this. And so I think that makes them, you know, really scary. It makes you think of, really creepy CIA type stuff, you know, we always love to have in our movies, all those kind of underhanded dealings like that, that political intrigue that we think of. And in some ways, the thinking about the internal nature of the Roman Empire and its politics is a lot like the Romulans in general towards the rest of the galaxy.
Right. And I think that despite the name Romulans, despite the name Romulus for the homeworld, of course, you had a Roman emperor named Romulus, Romulus Augustus, in the 5th century. The entity in Star Trek that is the most like the Roman Empire, I feel, does come down to the Dominion in Deep Space Nine. And so let's move on into their tactics directly and talk about the Dominion way, as I call it, which is the fact that they do prefer to conquer worlds through diplomacy rather than force. And a question I wanted to ask you about that, because the fact that they want to do that is clear because we see it on the screen, but how much of the Founder's past do you think influences the fact that this is the approach that they take? So long ago, they retreated into isolation after being persecuted by Solids. And so now it seems that they prefer to operate from a distance and avoid face-to-face contact whenever possible, certainly between the changelings and them. But I think even the Dominion as a whole doesn't necessarily want to interact with its subjects any more than necessary. How do you feel about that fact that they were forced to retreat to this rogue planet and how that influences the approach that they take now in the 24th century?
Well, it really reminds me of the idea of, a puppet master, and you are behind the scenes pulling all the strings, and that's very much what founders are, I think, is they are the puppet masters. They're pulling the strings behind the scenes. They've got the Vorta and the Jem'Hadar, and they've got all these ways of influencing without actually being the ones who do any of it, they just put these things out there to do it for them so they mm-hmm. can be safe and, behind the walls, on their planet inside a nebula, hidden from the rest of the galaxy. And as we realize, from the very beginning of Deep Space Nine, when we hear about the Dominion the first time, they're just this kind of nebulous idea, like the idea of the founders and everything. It's very ethereal, and you have no idea who they are. Nobody's seen them. They've only dealt with the Vorta or the Jem'Hadar, but they know there's something malevolent behind them, and so it's a really great setup that they've got, because they're not actually being the ones who have to be the influencers. They've created those, they control those, and they are able then to just sit back in quote unquote security. And that's scary.
Yeah. It feels like a Roman Empire situation, right? If you can imagine yourself during that time living in the outskirts somewhere, in areas in Asia or Africa that were under control of the Roman Empire, if someone plopped you down in the middle of that, you may really have no idea that this is going on. You may have no idea who is overseeing you, but yet they are. They're there, but you just don't really know.
Yeah. When I think about that, Chris, I really think about that kind of, I think of the biblical reference, mainly because that's why I know so much about the Romans and their tactics. But, way they oversaw, say, Palestine at the time is to have a governor set up. They had, puppet kings set up to control. They had their legions there just in case they needed them, but otherwise they were pretty hands off. They had local people be tax collectors to collect the taxes from the people that they had annexed or conquered or any of those things. But otherwise, those people's lives went pretty much on the same way. And yet mm-hmm. there was always this creepy, like really malevolent force behind everything, and you felt the oppression, even if you couldn't point to the founders.
Right.
Whereas in Rome, everybody knew it, Right. Everybody knew it was Caesar. But I mean, here with the Dominion, it's even more creepy because you've never seen a Founder. You have no idea what they're like. You know, I mean, it's just a...
Right.
It's a much scarier thing in some ways.
Yeah, yeah, it is. What do you think their goal is? So if they want to stay on this rogue planet where they don't have to come into contact with anyone else, they let the Vorta and the Jem'Hadar do their bidding, but yet they want to conquer worlds. They want to take over the galaxy. What's their motivation?
You know, Chris, I think their motivation is control. What you can control, you don't have to worry about. And by controlling all these planets, all these systems, all these quadrants, what they want of the galaxy, the more people you have subjugated under you, the less you have to worry about as you sleep at night or as you hang out in the Great Lake, you know, souping around.
So that goes back to what I was saying, that their past persecution leads them to the tactics that they have now, right? That they just, they want to, it's like maybe the kid who's bullied in school, you know, who grows up to want to keep everything, to control everything, because that way that can't happen to them again.
Yeah, I think very much like that. And they really have found a way to be able to pull that off by doing, you know, They've created two entire races. Whether the Vorta were actually a race that they, you know, gave sentience to and kind of grew, or, you know, became something instead that they had just created in general and put that in their heads that they're that. I mean, the Jem'Hadar, which they've genetically created to be the, you know, killing machines that serve only the Founders. This is definitely an intense belief that they have, that this is the only way to keep themselves safe. And yet, I think it's a great dichotomy to, say, the Federation, which they know the risk of seeking out new life and new civilizations, and they're willing to pay the risk because the benefit that they feel like they get from it is greater than the risk. Whereas the Founders have found it the other way. They don't care. Mm-hmm. They want nothing but to be safe. And maybe that's because, I don't know, we don't know enough about the Founders to say how do they reproduce. You know, are all the Founders that are there all that will ever be? Like, can there never be any more? We don't know any of those things. So maybe their self-protection because they realize if they die, if they're all killed, you know, there wouldn't be any more Founders because they can't create anymore. So I don't know. That's something that's a really interesting question, because I don't think we ever get that answered in the series or even the novels or anything like that.
No, not really. And I think it's because on television, in order for the viewer to wrap their mind around the conflicts that's going on, they had to have the Founders take these humanoid forms. So it gives us the feeling that there are these individual Founders, they're individual entities. Whereas I think in reality, it seems like the Founders are one entity that can manifest itself in individual forms. But there is the Great Link. There is this one entity. And if that were destroyed, that would be the end of them. It doesn't seem like they reproduce. It seems like they can simply manifest themselves differently. And you see that in Star Trek here and there a few times. Again, an Enterprise reference that comes to mind is in Vox Sola, where you have that creature that's on the Enterprise who turns out to be just part of a single planet-wide entity. We saw that also in the comics. I think it was at the Frontier Doctor comics where they go to that planet and the vegetation is all like one planet-wide life form. So you see that from time to time. And I feel like that is ultimately what the Founders are, what the Changelings are. And so that could be self-preservation, that if anything happens to them. And that would also explain maybe why they like this rogue planet that no one's ever going to find. They're very safe there.
Yeah, and it definitely leads them to doing whatever it takes to know their enemy. And that we really see that the first time that we meet them there, in the, especially the second part of the search, where they've captured the Starfleet officers. They've put them in this scenario all together that, you know, the Dominion and the Federation have made peace, and they have pushed them to the point to see how far humans would go to give up for peace. Like, how many freedoms, how much liberty would they give up? Which is funny, because in the end, I think that's a very American question. It's a very American revolutionary type of idea. Like, how many liberties will you give up before you, revolt, before you create a revolution? And, you know, I mean, we see that all the world, but obviously being a show written mainly by people from America really jives well with what we know of American history.
Right. And this is the next topic in the discussion here, is testing the waters as the Dominion did by putting these implanted memories in. And as you said, trying to find out what the Federation would agree to. But I think it's even more than just that. I think that what they're trying to do is not only find out what kind of liberties the Federation is willing to give up in the name of peace, I think they're also trying to figure out how multiple scenarios here. Because we know in the actual war, we know that the Dominion, well, Cardassia becomes part of the Dominion, so they pit the Cardassians against the Federation alliance. The Klingons and the Romulans and the Federation come together, which is something I have a feeling that the Dominion probably didn't anticipate happening. But in this situation, I think they're trying to find out, what would the Federation be willing to do to the Romulans? How would the Romulans react to what the Federation did? How would humans react to the presence of the Dominion, which manifests itself in the scene in the bar where the Jem'Hadar goes up and attacks Miles, and Eddington's there, and Bashir says, "Is that it? You're just going to let him walk away?" And Eddington says, "Our orders are to give the Jem'Hadar a wide berth." And Bashir says, "Look, I know what the orders say, but he attacked Chief O'Brien, and we have rules against that sort of thing here." So I think that they're trying to figure out, yes, the Federation has rules, but how much are they willing to bend the rules depending on how we push their buttons?
Yeah, it is really interesting thing, because by putting them in that scenario, they give them the ability to learn what they need to learn without really having to actually do anything about it. They just get to test out the scenario and learn all they need to know without really any harm coming to anybody. And other than, I think, you know, creating some mistrust at the beginning here with the Federation and the Dominion. Although I think you can tell right away that the Dominion has no interest whatsoever really in being peaceful with anybody. They only want to control everyone. And they're very kind of clear in that, even with their intentions towards the officers here in the search, where they are putting them through this scenario, testing them, seeing what's going to happen if they were to, say, try and take over, like, this scenario that they play out.
Right. And in testing that out, trying to find out what's going to happen, but there are imperfections in it as well, right? That's what I think about when I'm watching it. Like, how do they... I guess the machines they have them hooked up to somehow can tap into the part of, like, a subconscious part of the brain of, like, how each individual person would react to certain situations based on, because as we learn, you know, our brain forms pathways. And so maybe based on that, the Dominion has some sort of technology that allows them to extrapolate realistic scenarios based on the past experiences of people. And so that's how they were able to create these visions, because it does seem a little bit odd, right? As everything's going on the station, like, how do they know this is what Sisko would say, or that Garak would come up? But I guess I love the scene with Sisko and Garak in particular, and Sisko says, you know, Mr. Garak, I never knew that we thought so much alike. But I guess subconsciously, you know, Sisko has picked up on how Garak sees situations. And so that's manifesting itself in this vision based on Sisko's mind.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that they would definitely have to have some way to kind of tap into that kind of personality center of somebody. You would have to, or this situation wouldn't work. I mean, you really wouldn't get to learn anything from, right. You know, who you're testing if it can't give you those kind of answers. And so, in and of itself, having that kind of technology is kind of scary. Although, mm-hmm. I guess it does in some ways, I think, mirror like holodeck technology. I mean, holodeck can read your brain waves. It can know how you're reacting. I mean, it has to be that sophisticated to be able to run the kind of programs that it has. And I think even the safety measures that it would have. So we've kind of seen that before, but this seems to be kind of like one step further in that process. And again, I think a kind of really scary idea as well. Yeah. Like this is something that the Dominion can kind of get in, really figure out who you are and what you're about in a way that leaves you really vulnerable.
It does. Yeah. So however the technology works, I think what's interesting here is what information they're searching for. And
they're searching for...
Yes, that's why it's called The Search. It's not searching for the founders. It's not Odo searching for his people.
That's
it's
right.
What the Dominion is searching for inside the Sisko's mind. And they found a Chaya. And they went, oh my God, her again? But it's interesting because you can look at it in one way of them just trying to find out, would the Federation make concessions or will we have to invade them? But I also think that the founders, they realize that if the Federation and the Romulans, I guess the Klingons never come into play at this point in time, do they? It's really the Cardassians, the Federation, and the Romulans, right? Because the Cardassians are in favor of the treaty.
Right.
The Romulans are upset that they have been excluded. And I think that the founders know that if the Federation, the Cardassians, and the Romulans were to join forces, they would have trouble fighting against that force. And so they know that they need to split these groups up. And the scenario is very interesting, especially the conversation between Sisko and Nechayev. They're probing to find out, like, can we split these people up? Is it possible? And what would we need to do? And we know that the point of entry of any invasion is going to be the wormhole. Sisko is there. How is Sisko going to react as well? And is he going to be a rogue element in our plan?
Well, and it's interesting, too, because I don't think that they're able to find out through this test just exactly who they're dealing with in the sense of what the Federation is willing to do. I think at this point, they don't know about, say, something like Section 31 in the Federation, mm-hmm. because we don't know about Section 31 in the Federation at this point. And none of the characters that they have here do either. And that really does come into play. And it's also interesting, too, that you also have somebody like, you know, Sisko and Garak are going to be two of the architects of bringing the Romulans into the war on the Federation Klingon side and really turn that tide in the war. And they're not really able to figure that part out either. I mean, this idea, too, I think, is in this scenario, they find out a lot of information, but you really don't find out everything about a person, you know, like, and especially right. with a character like, say, Sisko, they don't find out just exactly what it is, how far he'll be pushed before he does something that, say, might go against his normal set of code or ethics or so, all those kind of things that we've talked about before. You know, it's an interesting way to find out about your enemy. but there's a lot of gaps. There's a lot of holes that get left in this. And so it's a good way to start, but obviously you couldn't trust all of it because there's so much that they didn't find out because there's so much that plays out later on.
Exactly. And I think what they do get out of it is that they do realize that Sisko is not going to go along with things very easily. When he finally confronts Nechayev and Boroth, who is a Vorta but is interestingly presented as a founder initially here, and that on the one hand you might feel like, well, it was just the writing, they like accidentally called him a founder or something, but no, I think it is the changelings. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be known, right? So they're saying, oh yeah, these guys, they're the founders, yeah, and then later on they're more willing to reveal the actual structure. But Nechayev tells Sisko that, you know, Bajor will fall under Dominion control. It will be protected. Sisko asks about the wormhole, and she says it's the price of peace, Benjamin. And Sisko says, well, if you ask me, the price is too damned high. What is the Federation mm-hmm. supposed to get out of all this? And then Boroth says, our friendship. Isn't that enough? Mm-hmm. And of course it's not. And so that's where I think something that they gained from testing the waters here is to find out that this straightforward come in, try to make friends with the Federation, that's not going to work. And so that leads us to the fallout and the repercussions of all this. And you mentioned earlier on that one thing that comes from all of this is some mistrust being established between the Federation and the Founders and the Dominion. And also, Sisko is even more on guard than he would have been otherwise mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. due to what the Founders did here and with these implanted memories and all. And you also mentioned Sisko and Garak, you know, joining forces later on, which is interesting here because we do see them there sitting down together and talking there towards the end, and the fact that they do come together later on in the pale moonlight to bring the Romulans into the war. So how do you feel everything that played out here influenced the remainder of the series and the conflict between the Federation and the Dominion?
Well, it's interesting to me that, you know, say in the Gamma Quadrant, the Founders have never really faced, I think, a quadrant like the Alpha Quadrant, where you have such major powers. I feel almost as if the Founders have been around so long that they've been able to really, you know, cement themselves as the firm power. Yeah. Whereas when you come to the Alpha Quadrant, I mean, you have three major powers with a bunch of smaller powers in the mix. You know, and any of those factions could join any side depending on where they think their best interest is going to be. You know, so the Founders do. I mean, they come into the Alpha Quadrant. They pick the Cardassians to be the people that they're going to sign this pact with, and then of course they gain the Breen later on, and yet they've just never really faced this kind of enemy before, and it really went to show me that they severely underestimate the Alpha Quadrant powers mm-hmm. and yeah. their desire for freedom, and especially the Federation, the Klingons, and the Romulans. None of those three powers wants to be under anybody else's rule.
Right.
You know, even though the Klingons at this point are very friendly with the Federation, they're part of the Khitomer Accords. It's very interesting. And we'll see this later on, because the other repercussions are is that the Founders do their damnedest, basically, to disrupt the powers in the Alpha Quadrant as much as possible. They create the Cardassian Klingon War. Trying to decimate the Klingons before they, you know, they might join with the Cardassians.
And they make everyone believe that Gowron is a changeling.
Exactly. You know, so they do their best, and they continue to kind of create this kind of underhandedness. And they really continue that on as well to the point where you get to the fact that Tukat has secretly been meeting with the Dominion.
Yeah.
They really push forward this mentality that they have of doing things behind the scenes. And yet, you know, you can see that how their plan changed a little bit in the fact that they're actually willing to have changelings get involved, not just the Vorta or the Jem'Hadar, but they're willing to use their nature as shapeshifters to make things happen that they mm-hmm. want at that point. And so I think, too, that we get the repercussions is they are frightened of what they found out.
Very truly frightened. Feel threatened. Yeah. Definitely.
And yet what's so interesting is that what they don't realize is that if they had stayed neutral or friendly, the Federation would have been threat to them whatsoever. In fact, if the Federation had been told by the Dominion, stay out of our space, the Federation would have abided by those laws. You know, so there really was no threat from the Federation specifically. Now the Klingons, the Romulans, the Cardassians, that's a different story, but you know, the largest power in the Alpha Quadrant would have been no threat to them.
But even ultimately, I think the Klingons and the Romulans would have left them alone if they hadn't.
Yeah, I mean, why would you go after such a huge threat yourself? I mean, the Klingons are no match for the entire, you know, Dominion. The Cardassians aren't either. The Romulans aren't. Right. So, and you know, the Federation controls the wormhole. So,
yeah. Yeah, right. The Federation controlled the wormhole. So, and even if they didn't, I don't think the Klingons would particularly have this great urge to go into the Gamma Quadrant and start conquering lots and lots of worlds for the Klingon Empire, because there's plenty of a more nearby space for them to deal with. So,
right, right. It is. I do think too, like you said, that the one of the biggest repercussions though is that by creating this mistrust, they put Starfleet and especially Sisko on high alert for any activity for the Dominion. And that's really, I think, the seed of their downfall is that they've kind of played their hand about how devious they're going to be. And they continue to play that hand out with the Klingons and the Cardassian War that they create. And it again continues to put people on edge. And of course, the entire Dominion War in general. And so it's interesting that they don't seem to learn that really, honestly, the best way to keep themselves safe at that point would have been, let's just stay in our space, not worry about them at all. You know, it's their thirst for control of things and their fear that they won't control something that, you know, leads them to destruction. And almost annihilation.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, with the Section 31 and the virus. And I mean, they really had no idea that this could be brought upon them. I think mainly because they've been hiding too long.
Well, that's another repercussion of the failure of the experiment in the second part of the search. Like you were saying, they can't really find out everything and they don't know about Section 31 yet. And I don't think they ever anticipated that the Federation would resort to tactics like that. And officially the Federation wouldn't, but there was this arm that would, and they had no way of anticipating that.
Well, and I mean, they know about, you know, say the Tal Shiar or, you know, something like Klingon intelligence. So, I mean, there's other places out there that this could happen.
Yeah.
You know, especially the Tal Shiar. And the Tal Shiar has already tried to attack the Founders once with the, you know, Nabarin Tain and the Obsidian Mortar. So, I mean, they're already well familiar with the fact that humanoid species like the Romulans or the Klingons or the humans do have this proclivity for doing anything and everything to stay free and alive, the same way that the Founders do. So it's interesting that they don't regard that sense of freedom and desire as much as their own desire for control. Like they discount it. Like they just, it's almost like their pride gets in the way. We're too good to be taken down by solids.
Right. And, you know, they didn't know about Section 31 because it's the benefit of wearing all black. Because the Tal Shiar, the Obsidian Order with their fancy uniforms, they draw attention to themselves, whereas it's the true. All black, they can hide the shadows.
I mean, the Tal Shiar with those shoulder pads and
yeah,
goodness. I mean, how could you not see that coming?
But no, it's an excellent point. They just didn't anticipate that the Federation would do this, even though they should have, because they are fearful of solids, because they know these are the trends, the things that solids do, and yet they didn't foresee it here. So, well, Matthew, it has been a very interesting discussion today of the Dominion and their tactics, and seeing how this is the beginning of Season 3, this entire war arc and the storyline of DS9, which we tend to think of as being more in the latter couple of seasons, really started quite early on. But it's not the only thing that we've been talking about on Trek FM this week, so here are some other things that you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
TOS Remastered with Dave Rossi.
We took one day and we all went down in front of a green screen. I had a Captain Kirk shirt on. I don't remember where I got it from. Oh, yes, I do. My closet.
Earl Grey.
Ensign Row Commentary.
Here we have someone who is kind of bucking authority and is kind of trying to go against the grain, but she does it in a way that shows that she has some sort of depth of character.
The Orb.
His Way Commentary.
I love that he says, what does fun have to do with Major Kira? And James Darren's like, What do you mean, what is fun? Come on.
Face palm.
Yeah, exactly.
The Ready Room.
The Catwalk.
But this was a really, his trainer, Scott Rowe, was talking about in the interview I did with him back in the day, how this was a hard show because normally when they had Porthos, it was Scott and Porthos working. And maybe one other character or two other characters. And these, if you watch how Porthos was in this show, they kind of had him in the quarters with Scott, and I watched most of the show. I didn't see the last nth degree of it. But most of the time, they would do stuff with him, like peeking out of a bulkhead and all that.
To the journey!
USS Voyager.
If it was, like, really blooming with color, you're like, oh, they're going really fast or something's happening. Like, you could...
Yeah, excitement!
Like, it was instantly... you instantly knew exactly what was going on.
And if Q Jr. is on board, it becomes a disco.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Harlan Ellison
is a crazy person, because only a crazy person could come up with such an amazing name for a sci-fi drug. Come on, that's so much better than bath salts. Why don't we call them the Jewels of Sound?
Warp 5.
Trip Tucker.
You know, they're not really career Starfleet people, even though Trip has had a career in Starfleet. He's an engineer, you know, and that's what he does, and that's what he loves. And so all this other stuff's really new to him.
Literary Treks.
The best of Klingons.
We haven't talked about yet, Chris, but there is one Klingon in here that is not like the other.
That's right. One of these Klingons is not like the other. One of these Klingons doesn't belong.
One of these Klingons is a friend of the Federation.
One of these Klingons and Bryce will get along.
Wow, this show has gone off the rails.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new shows for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in a variety of places, including iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. You can download or stream from the website. We have many, many ways for you to get the shows, and you can find links to everything at trek.fm/pd for podcast directory. All right, Matthew, let's tell everyone how to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on the Dominion and their tactics or anything DS9 or Star Trek. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Orb, and that will come to Matthew and me both by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about the show and Star Trek. And in social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And you'll find us on Twitter, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, when you're not hooking your friends up to machines and putting implanted memories in them to find out how they'll react to your next devious plan, where can people find you?
Chris, after that lead-in, I'm not sure who's going to want to contact me ever. Find me at MattRushing02 on Twitter. I apologize. I'm still talking a lot of Doctor Who. But you know, if you want to talk to me about anything sports, football, or of course Star Trek, Star Trek literature, anything like that, give me an at reply. Let me know you're following me. Have a great conversation. And then, of course, Chris and I do Literary Treks, where we talk books and comics every week, and so you can join us there. And I do have my own personal blog. It's 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Do all sorts of things there, movie reviews, other book reviews, and stuff like that. So if you're just interested in knowing a little bit more about me or just some of my other hobbies, you can find me there. Now, Chris, when you're not hanging out with shape-shifting weirdos and trying to figure out how to become one yourself, where can we find you?
You'll find me searching for mystery doors that shouldn't be where they are. And when I'm done doing that, you'll find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then on the network, of course, besides doing Literary Treks with you, Matthew, you can find me on Warp 5 with Kate Walsh, where we talk about Enterprise exclusively, very much like we do Deep Space Nine here on The Orb. You can also find me on The Ready Room, sometimes with you, Matthew, as well as all the other hosts from around the network and other special guests as we talk about Star Trek news and all five live-action Star Trek series and the occasional special topic as well. And you'll also find me on my own interview show, Matterstream, where I interview actors and writers and scientists and all sorts of people about topics loosely related to Star Trek. And for you Deep Space Nine fans, be sure to check out the most recent episode that's up, because I'm talking to Armin Shimerman about the latest project that he's working on. So I had a really great chat with Armin there, and you can find that at trek.film/ms for Matterstream. Also, before we let everyone go, Matthew, we'd like to remind everyone to please support our sponsor for this week's show. Your support of our sponsor makes it possible for us to bring The Orb to you each week, and our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible, as we've talked about on many of our shows recently, is a great way for you to read all the books that you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have time for, because, Matthew, a lot of us can't read as quickly as you can. I haven't read 57 books this year like you have. And you said you were behind pace, right?
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed with myself this year. But I read a lot of epic poetry at the beginning of the year, and I think that slowed me down. So,
All right. Well, I think you can get epic poetry on Audible as well. But I know that you can get many, many of the books that you love to read, because Audible is the premier source of audiobooks. They have more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and there are new titles coming every week. I've been an Audible member since 2000 myself, so going on 14 years here, and I listen to all sorts of things from there, of course Star Trek stuff, other science fiction, business books as well, all kinds of things that they have on there. They have some of the most famous Star Trek books like Prime Directive, Federation, and Spock's World on there. They also have some Deep Space Nine novels, some read by Armin Shimerman, Nana Visitor, and René Auberjonois. Really great stuff there. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice, along with a 30-day trial to see how great Audible is, by just going to audibletrial.com/trekfm to sign up. And you're going to love Audible, and your support of them really helps us keep The Orb coming to you every week. So please drop by, try it out. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we really thank Audible for their support of The Orb and the network. And lastly, there is one more way you can support what we're doing here at Trek FM if you'd like to, and get something in return. And those are the great original alien illustrations that we have done by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on the website. We have them as badges. Those are little 44mm buttons. Also as art prints as well. And you can mix and match, choose which ones you want in which format. And there are different contribution levels that you can make as well. And we'd like to thank some of our most recent contributors. We've had quite a few of them. We'd like to thank Mike Crate, Gary Lum, Daniel Hanlon, Hans Liebetzetter. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name there, Hans. And also an anonymous donor who made a really, really generous contribution, Matthew, in honor of the 100th episode of Trek News and Views, as well as the 50th episode of To the Journey. And so we really thank everyone who has contributed. And you really do help us keep the shows coming to you. every week because we have to pay for the costs of production, of course, hosting, and bandwidth because we have really high bandwidth and it does cost us quite a bit to get the shows out to you every week. So you can find all of this at trek.fm/donate, and your support does help us keep things coming, and we really appreciate your help with everything we do here at Trek FM.
Thank you everyone for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.